We're back with more one-star reviews of classic philosophy and literature. But this time, it's with a bit of a twist, because I think it is important to note when these one-star reviews have a point. So here are the critiques of some books that I absolutely adore, that I actually think have something in them that we ought to listen to. My name is Joe Folley, and this is Unsolicited Advice. Right, here we have a very unhappy review of Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, and it reads as follows. The problem with this book is that it's blatantly didactic. Dostoevsky was a Christian who believed in objective morality derived from the Word of God. He had a bee in his bonnet because guys like Nietzsche were going around saying God is dead and that people had to create their own subjective moral code, that a person could be the judge and executioner of their own law. Dostoevsky wrote Crime and Punishment as a reaction against these ideas, which is why the book reads like a really bloated version of an Aesopian fable, only without the cute animals. So while Crime and Punishment may look on the outside like a boring realist novel about people walking around on rickety staircases slowly dying of tuberculosis, really, it's nothing but a moral sermon dressed up as fiction. So, first of all, there are just a couple of minor factual errors in this review. Dostoevsky's not reacting to Nietzsche. This book came out a long time before Nietzsche published his works like Thus Spake Zarathustra or The Gay Science, which declared that God was dead and advocated for this idea that people would be able to create their own values in a kind of post-theistic world. In some ways, one of the most impressive things about Crime and Punishment is that Dostoevsky is able to anticipate these ideas in their more mature form simply from the kind of rational egoism that he already had access to amongst kind of 1860s Russian intellectuals. However, I do think that this review hits upon something that can be a little bit frustrating if, like me, you both love reading Dostoevsky but also don't happen to be a theist yourself. Yes, there are points where it can come across a little bit like a moral sermon. However, I would say that on the whole, I think those bits are few and far between. I think that Dostoevsky's treatment of atheism as a worldview is actually like reasonably sympathetic in a weird way. He obviously disagrees with it and actually thinks it's corrosive to society, but you really get inside someone like Raskolnikov's head and see how he came to the conclusions that Dostoevsky disagreed with. But yes, the contents of Dostoevsky's books, and particularly his philosophical position in those books, is inseparable from Orthodox Christianity. On the other hand, I do think we can go too far in characterizing Dostoevsky as this sort of uncritical Christian thinker. You know, he's simply parroting the standard Orthodox Christian line. But in a lot of his books, especially the later ones, he arguably has just as much satire of some forms of Christianity as he endorses other forms. I think the best example of this is probably in The Brothers Karamazov, where he contrasts the elder Zosima with another character who's much less well known called Father Ferapont. And Father Ferapont is this sort of satire of the kind of Christian who will badger you for not going to church or not following these exact sacraments, but in their everyday life is incredibly judgmental, is not anyone you'd recognize as a kind or humble or Christ-like person, and is just in general kind of a bit of a dick. And this is very much in contrast with the elder Zosima, who may not be as enthused with the particularities of the sacraments, but bases his Christianity around this overarching idea of active love, which Dostoevsky is incredibly keen on. The elder Zosima is probably the closest thing in any of Dostoevsky's novels to a mouthpiece for what Dostoevsky thinks humanity ought to believe. Even though there's another character in Demons called Shatov, which is almost like Dostoevsky's really quite harsh self-portrait. It's the character that he said was the most like him when he looked back on his books. But also, Shatov is not having a good time. It's not like Dostoevsky created this very, very exemplary self-insert character. Shatov has many, many flaws that Dostoevsky does not hesitate to explore. But anyway, back to Dostoevsky's Christian views. My overall point is that it's very easy to kind of sort Dostoevsky into the box of, oh, like Christian thinkers who just want us to follow the Bible uncritically and not tackle any kind of questions like the problem of evil, and they just want us to follow the sacraments and not worry about anything else. And Dostoevsky just isn't that kind of thinker. In fact, not many religious thinkers that have gone down in history are. I think that if they were just parroting that kind of line, I just don't think they'd end up being remembered. I'm not suggesting there aren't theologians that have written very extensively on the sacraments, but they tend to have a much more nuanced take than just follow them blindly and don't worry about anything else. So I think that this reviewer does have a point. Dostoevsky is a very Christian author, and sometimes that can seem a little bit like moral lecturing. But at the same time, he's certainly not a simplistic author, and a lot of his moral lessons, if you could call them that, aren't limited to Christianity. A lot of them are arguably to do with moral psychology, right? I mean, one of the things that a lot of people, including secular thinkers, take away from Crime and Punishment is this idea that you can't run from your conscience. You know, Raskolnikov thinks he has all of these justifications to kill the old pawnbroker and then ends up killing her sister, who never really comes up again. But then when he's actually done the deed, he can't live with himself. He is torn apart by guilt and fear that he'll get caught, and he places himself in judgment of the wider community. It's only after he's begged for repentance and asked to be let back into the moral order of his community that he can begin to forgive himself. And I'm not saying that this idea is flawless. There are certainly critiques you can make of it, but Dostoevsky's not simply regurgitating Bible quotes. Another good example of a secular tinge lesson from Crime and Punishment is Raskolnikov places himself in a superior position to others, and this ultimately sets him up for failure because he also craves the affection of others. He wants to connect with other people on an equal footing and love others as equals. You see this in his relationship to Sonya. Initially, he kind of treats Sonya with quite a lot of contempt because she reflects back to him his own shortcomings, and in her unrelenting kindness and forgiving nature, he sees that he's not superior to other people. He learns to respect another person as potentially superior to him, and he learns to humble himself in front of the general moral sphere of his society. And again, this is a lesson that stretches well beyond Christianity. In some ways, it actually connects quite nicely to the kind of recognition theory that would develop out of Hegel and then well into the 20th and 21st century. So yes, I do think that this reviewer does have a point, and I do see why he found reading the more religiously tinged passages of Dostoevsky a little bit frustrating, especially if, you know, unlike me, you have literally no sympathy with that worldview, as many more anti-theist thinkers might. On the other hand, it doesn't follow from this that every aspect of Dostoevsky's philosophy or his novels are rendered worthless if you're an atheist thinker. And I think that we are potentially depriving ourselves of quite a lot of wisdom and insight if we choose to do this. But anyway, moving on. But before we move on, I want to take a brief moment to thank today's very kind sponsor, Skillshare. Skillshare is a phenomenal online learning platform with classes on various different topics. You can find high-quality classes on anything from painting skills to party tricks to website design. I've so far taken their classes on touch typing, as well as interior design and music history, and even some cooking skills, and I'm very happy with what I've learned. Most recently, I've used their classes on Notion and note organization more generally to get much more together with all of my research, which has helped me save hours of time, made my work much more efficient, and stopped that nasty habit I had of losing days' worth of work to misplaced notes. Skillshare is a long-term sponsor of this channel because I've really loved learning different skills from them. I feel like I'm slowly accumulating all of these little hobbies and interests that just help life seem that bit more full, that bit richer. The first 500 people to use my link will get a 1 month free trial of Skillshare. So give the link a click to check it out. But anyway, back to the video. Okay, next we have a deeply unhappy review of Marcel Proust's Swan's Way, which is part of his 7-volume epic In Search of Lost Time, or Remembrance of Things Past if you prefer. And this person has said the following. There are probably half a dozen books I've abandoned unfinished in the past 10 years. Swan's Way is now firmly on that list. It wasn't horribly written or full of heinous immorality. It was just astoundingly dull. I only made it through maybe 60 pages, and nothing whatsoever had occurred by that point. The protagonist, can I call a character that if they never act, regales the reader with an interminable and disjointed string of maudlin memories and angst-ridden reflections. Now, I wanted to talk about this review because I think that anyone who's read any part of Proust will just relate to having that feeling at some point. I think this person actually does have a real point behind their review. I don't think that most people who would consider themselves Proust fans would disagree. I've not read all of In Search of Lost Time. I really wish I had. It's just absolutely enormous and I haven't got around to it. I've read the first volume, which is the review this person's talking about, which is called Swan's Way. And I'll tell you what, I've actually just started rereading it because I left my copy on a train the other day, and I've got my new one here that I ordered the other day, and I will just read you out a section from like the third page, which, as I say, I've just started rereading it, so I'm still pretty early on. God, is this a copyright problem? I don't think it is. I think this counts as fair use. So, to clarify here, Proust is describing the process of waking up. I could not be sure at first who I was. I had only the rudimentary sense of existence, such as may lurk and flicker in the depths of an animal's consciousness. I was more destitute of human qualities than the cave dweller, but then the memory, not yet of the place in which I was, but of various other places where I had lived and might now very possibly be, would come like a rope let down from heaven to draw me up out of the abyss of non-being from which I could have never escaped by myself. In a flash, I would traverse and surmount centuries of civilization, and out of a half-visualized succession of oil lamps, followed by shirts with turned-down collars, would put together, by degrees, the component parts of my ego. So, that's Proust describing waking up from a dream. It is very cool in a whole host of ways. I think that actually does sort of capture that feeling of coming to after a long spell of unconsciousness. It is also absurdly long-winded, right? And I think that this is a totally fair complaint to have about Proust. In fact, it's a complaint that I have about Proust sometimes. You know, I really enjoyed Swan's Way, and I think that in the right mindset, I would enjoy the rest of In Search of Lost Time, which is why I do plan to read it. But at the same time, if I sat down and read it in the wrong mood, if I was just a little bit agitated, or I had something to do later that day, or I was just busy, my mind was busy with thoughts of other things, it would come across as just incredibly dull. And I know it sounds like I'm just roasting Proust here. And to be clear, I do think that he's an absolute genius. And I think that because the depths of frustration that you have reading Proust in the wrong mood is only rivaled by the extremely positive experience that you can have reading Proust in the right mood. If you do happen to have a free evening and you literally have nowhere to be and you are time rich, right? You don't feel the kind of tug to be productive or the tug to do anything else with the next few hours, I would highly recommend reading Swan's Way, because in that frame of mind, it can actually be really enjoyable because of the way Proust describes things at such length. It's incredibly immersive. You really get into the character's head and you feel like you're in that world in a way that not many books really can. You know, it's totally immersive fiction, but it also reads incredibly slowly. And that's ideal if you do happen to have a long stretch of time that you are willing to devote to reading Proust. But certainly, it's a divisive experience. And I do think that frame of mind is rare enough that I do find it difficult to recommend Proust to many people. I mean, after all, like, I got to the first volume and was then like, God, I'm going to need a break before I pick up the second one, and then haven't picked up the second one. It's got to the point where it's been so long since I've read the first one that I'm having to read the first one again in order to recap what's happened so I can remember it for when I start the second one. So, yeah, I think that this one-star review of Proust, I think, is something that everyone can rally behind. I'm sure that, well, pretty much everyone I know that truly is into Proust, far more so than I am, and has read the whole of In Search of Lost Time all the way through, and sometimes more than once, have openly said that Proust at the wrong time or in the wrong frame of mind is genuinely hellish to read, and I can only concur with them. So yes, I think this one-star review does make an excellent point, but I still don't think that you should write off Proust entirely. I think that there is a lot of enjoyment to be had in his writing, but at the same time, it can be frustrating, especially if, you know, you're quite busy, right? Like, if you've got a job and family and hobbies and friends, then how often do you get an entire evening to devote to an early 20th century French novel? And to be honest, given that there's a significant chance that you'll pick it up and just find it boring anyway, I think that there's a good reason that this work has a lot of one-star reviews. And I think that it's not entirely the reviewer just misunderstanding the text, you know, that this is a genuine part of Proust's writing style that is incredibly frustrating, especially if you have somewhere to be, things to do, or just a life in general. I don't have much of a life outside of this channel and reading, so I suppose it's not the end of the world for me. But then again, I think that probably says more negative stuff about me than positive. So let's move swiftly on. Right. Next, we have a one-star review for Friedrich Nietzsche's Twilight of the Idols, and it reads as follows. I thought that he was too angry and not constructive enough. I could agree on some points, like his admiration of Dostoevsky and his disapproval of Plato, but he thoroughly misunderstands Christianity. Now, the reason I wanted to look at this review is because I do think that it hits on a couple of relevant critiques of Nietzsche, but also some misunderstandings, right? So at the beginning, they say that he was too angry. And I think that this is the impression that a lot of people get reading Twilight of the Idols. Nietzsche is significantly more aggressive, for want of a better word, in that text than he is, I would say, in basically any of his texts, right? I think that the difference is kind of subtle, but the only way I can put it into words is that when he is heaping scorn on someone in, say, Beyond Good and Evil or Thus Spake Zarathustra, which, you know, he often does, he seems to be nonetheless quite calm about it. He's kind of looking down on you in kind of an irritating way, especially if, you know, like myself, you feel called out by some of his comments around resentment or slave morality or something like that. And you think, oh, God, yeah, maybe I do sometimes use morality as a way to just justify the fact that I'm too weak or too unable to accomplish what I truly desire. That can be hard. That can be confronting when you're reading Nietzsche. It's not until Twilight of the Idols that you get the sense that Nietzsche is yelling at you or yelling at the people he's criticizing, right? I think that, you know, Twilight of the Idols strikes me as, yes, a much angrier version of Nietzsche. And the reason I find this really interesting is because in the very next book, The Antichrist, he doesn't come across as nearly as angry. If anything, I'd say that The Antichrist contains one of his most measured critiques of Christianity out there. He actually explicitly outlines his praise for the character of Jesus, the character of Christ. He says that Jesus was someone who had learnt to live without resentment. And this was, in Nietzsche's view, something perfectly admirable. You also get hints that he does admire the way that Jesus was able to flaunt the moral conventions of his society. For those of you that don't know, Nietzsche's project that he was going to undergo before he went mad, which is it's always a fascinating part of this Nietzsche story. Like, why did he go mad? Because, like, I think people used to think it was syphilis, and now they don't, on the whole. I watched a really good video on this, I think by Essential Salts, whose fantastic channel, by the way, if you don't already know. He does lots of videos on Nietzsche and is just awesome, man. Like, the kind of close analysis he does of Nietzsche texts is brilliant. Everyone should go watch it. I'll give a link to his channel in the description. But anyway, what was I talking about? Yeah, so one of the things that Christ does is manage to transcend the values of the community that he is embedded in. And I think that Nietzsche does, to a certain extent, admire this, and he admires his ability to not be resentful. But yes, despite the more measured tone of The Antichrist, Twilight of the Idols is quite a bombastic text. I also do want to touch upon this final point this person's had, that Nietzsche misunderstands Christianity. I think that there are aspects of Christianity that Nietzsche does understand and just genuinely disagrees with, right? I think that this idea of praying for those who persecute you, right? This is very distinct from anything that Nietzsche talks about and is highly at odds with his overall philosophy. You know, he'd probably call that suppressing an instinctive desire to achieve what you want and kind of express your will to power on the world and ultimately on yourself. I also think that Nietzsche would suggest that someone like Jesus had a natural asceticism. Something that comes up quite a lot in Nietzsche is the ascetic ideal, and he's heavily critical of this. He thinks this is the kind of the thing in both Christianity and in Schopenhauer, and also in humanism and all sorts of other ideologies and philosophies, which he thinks encourages us to suppress our baser instincts and weaken our wills. And he's heavily against that because he thinks it ultimately lays the groundwork for nihilism. But he does also talk about the natural ascetic, which is a different kind of figure who sort of takes joy in gradually hammering and redirecting their desires towards a kind of single organized point. I think this is partly what he's getting at in his kind of posthumously published notes about the organized and the disorganized will. And, you know, the disorganized will falls into passive nihilism, whereas the organized will has a bit more chance of what he calls active nihilism, which I think is relatively linked to his idea of somebody who would be able to make life seem meaningful in the wake of the death of God and all that sort of stuff. But anyway, I don't want to go into a rant about Nietzsche's whole philosophy. The other reason that I picked this review in particular was because I've been reading a lot of Orthodox Christian texts recently, kind of stuff by Orthodox theologians. And as a result, I've been learning a lot more about the Orthodox concept of theosis, which is partaking in the nature of God, not in the sense of like becoming God. Like, it's not like they think that you'll ascend to godhood, right? But it is in some way imitating Christ or taking part in the divine nature or the divine logos, it's sometimes called, in your everyday existence, in your character. And so, sorry, I'm pick up my phone. I've actually got the PDF of the book I'm reading, and I can't remember the name of the theologian. And also, I will mispronounce this name. I apologize to people in advance for that. The book is called Deification in Christ, The Nature of the Human Person, and it's by Panayiotis Nelas. I know, I'll just put it on the screen, or my wonderful video editor will put it on the screen. But anyway, I've been reading this and I've been finding it absolutely fascinating. And a lot of the prescriptions in this book to do with theosis are relatively similar to the kind of thing that Nietzsche really admires in Jesus, right? There's this scorning of resentment. And specifically, the thing that leapt out to me was this transmutation of suffering into joy, which, like, isn't too dissimilar from Nietzschean ideas about, you know, the kind of metamorphoses of the Übermensch. You know, one of the descriptions of the camel, which is one stage of the Übermensch in Thus Spake Zarathustra, is the camel learns to take joy in the kind of things that he's being laden with. And I don't know, man, maybe this is just like a complete hunch, or alternatively, it's something that loads of people have written about and I'm just really late to the party. In fact, it's almost certainly the second one. It's always the second one. There's never been a time where I've come up with an idea and I've been like, oh yeah, man, that's awesome. And then when I've not looked into it, it's turned out that actually that's had like a 200-year tradition or something like that. Actually, no, there have been a couple of times where that hasn't happened, but it's tended to be on like little technical stuff or how to represent something in logic or something like that. But anyway, this did get me thinking about whether, if Nietzsche had become more cognizant of this concept of theosis in Orthodox Christianity, whether that would have affected his view of Christianity as a whole. And I think that's just an interesting thought experiment. But yeah, I don't know. This got me thinking. I can't really say any more than that. Maybe one day I will do a video on Nietzsche and theosis and Orthodox Christianity, and whether there's something, some kind of coherence there, or whether one can be used to criticize the other or anything. But yeah, anyway, moving on. Okay, next we have a rather frustrated review of Plato's Republic, and it reads as follows. The Republic, abridged. Socrates, do you know what? Insert random, ridiculous claim here. Therefore, draws equally random and ridiculous conclusion from the previous statement. Mindless drone, oh my Greek gods, Socrates, you're so smart. That makes total sense. I'm going to go make out with the ground you walk on now because you're just that amazing. Socrates, oh, I'm just an innocent, humble philosopher. I don't actually know anything. Wink, wink. Yeah, right, Socrates. Yeah, right. So the reason that I picked out this review is because I think this does actually represent the Plato's dialogues at their absolute worst. There are passages in Plato that do read a little bit like this. You know, you'll have some kind of very extended and honestly, like, relatively questionable series of reasoning from the character of Socrates. And then someone else in the dialogue will just be like, indubitably so, Socrates. And you'll be sat there going, I don't think that is indubitably so at all. I think you could doubt that considerably. And yes, I do think there are certain passages that reflect this quite nicely. The one that springs to mind for me is a particular passage in the Meno. And it's been a while since I've read the Meno, so this could just be me caricaturing it. But Socrates, or the character of Socrates in Plato's dialogues, is trying to illustrate that when we learn things, we are remembering what we learnt when we were in the realm of the forms. In Platonic metaphysics, there's this realm of the forms that we inhabited before our birth, and then we came down and inhabited a body, and the realm of the forms contained all of the perfected versions of the stuff on Earth. So it contained the perfect triangle and the form of the good and the form of beauty. And then when we come down and we recognize things as triangles or beautiful or good, Plato thinks that we're remembering things. We're remembering the kind of experiences that we had in the realm of the forms. In a similar way that, you know, if I've seen, you know, a book before, I can go, right, yeah, I kind of know what this is. I can recognize other books. Plato thinks that that's already happened to all of us in the realm of the forms, which is like, this is a very controversial idea. And I don't know anyone actually who believes that today, like among philosophers, I suppose. Modern Platonists tend to keep Plato's metaphysics, but they tend not to keep this story about innate knowledge. And they also tend to only use Plato's metaphysics about certain things like maths, or for some people, ethics and stuff like that. The character Socrates is trying to give evidence for this. And he brings a boy over and says, look, I'm going to draw some mathematical figures on the ground. I want you to perform certain operations with them. And then he just talks the boy through the process of doing them in a way that for us today is very clearly leading, right? He's basically just asking the questions in such a way that the boy could not help but figure out what they're meant to be doing. And Socrates sort of uses this as evidence that the boy had encounters with perfect mathematical objects in the realm of the forms, and he's now using his knowledge from that. And I just don't think that holds up. I think that that is almost the perfect example of what this person has said here. You know, Socrates gives a very, very long, quite questionable argument, and then at the end, seemingly no one picks up on perhaps some of the weak spots in Socrates' line of reasoning. On the other hand, I don't want to take Plato too much to task on this, because some of his dialogues actually, I think, do represent two positions and one overcoming the other in quite interesting ways. Again, another good example of this is right at the beginning of the Republic, where Socrates is arguing with Glaucon about the definition of good. And Glaucon says, what's good is what benefits the powerful and what the powerful want to do. And Socrates basically says this is inconsistent. What if the powerful have a self-destructive urge? What if they don't know what's good for them? What if they don't know what will bring them pleasure, if you want to put it in purely hedonic terms? And this just is a good argument. Glaucon's position is inconsistent. And I still think that that argument sometimes crops up in debates around morality. So I think that actually self-destructive beliefs are under-examined in debates around egoism and morality, and whether there can be a kind of system of rational egoism that underpins any kind of moral system. So yeah, I think that Plato's argument through Socrates there is a prime example of the Platonic dialogue at its best, but that doesn't mean that there aren't examples of the Platonic dialogue at its worst. I'm also hesitant to just like condemn Plato in the way that some of these one-star reviews do. You know, they're just like saying, oh, Plato, you idiot, how couldn't you have seen that this is a faulty reasoning pattern? And I think sometimes we don't realize just how much logical innovation went on in the 19th century. So in the 19th century, you had like Boole and Frege and all sorts of various different logicians doing Peano's another really good one. Now you have all of these logicians doing various different incredibly exciting stuff. And the formal logical notational systems that come out of that just make gaps and flaws in logical chains so much easier to spot. So much so that I actually think that it's kind of filtered into the way that people just in general perceive arguments. I think maybe one of the ways this has happened is through like coding languages, because a lot of coding languages are kind of loosely Phrygian in the way they're constructed. You know, a lot of them are based on modern mathematical logic, which traces its history back to Frege, and then, you know, through Russell and Whitehead, and then you've got Gödel. Anyway, Turing and all sorts. The history of logic is fascinating in its own right. But my point for this is that when we are talking about figures in the past, be they Plato or be they like a lot of medieval theologians or philosophers, you know, I read a lot of medieval philosophers when I was at university, and definitely there I kind of became tempted to be like, oh well, like how haven't they spotted that this is just a flaw in their logical construction? And then looking back on it, I think, oh yeah, but like would I have spotted that if I didn't have access to these incredibly powerful modern ways of thinking about reasoning that they just didn't? So yeah, not everything in Plato is perfectly reasoned out. In fact, quite a lot of it isn't perfectly reasoned out by modern philosophical or logical standards. But I don't think that should necessarily stop you from reading him, even if I think this reviewer does hit upon something really quite relatable with their frustrations at reading aspects of Plato. Right, next we have a one-star review for Albert Camus' The Myth of Sisyphus, and it says this. The Myth of Sisyphus is clearly a book of philosophy advocating for the idea that life is absurd. Camus makes a lot of claims about the human condition, but I can't trace any logical reasoning chain through his words. He won a Nobel Prize in Literature, so clearly someone understands him, but it isn't me. This was a hard slog of a read, even though the book is only 150 pages. Now, first, I want to talk about what I do agree with about this review. Not much of The Myth of Sisyphus is straightforward logical argumentation in the way that would satisfy a kind of hard-nosed analytic philosopher, which ultimately I kind of am. So like, I sympathize with this person's frustrations just generally about reading existential philosophy or aspects of continental philosophy. You know, there are points where you go, oh, like, I can't tease out what this person's getting at. Are they hinting at something deeper, or are they just using a leap in logic and it's quite difficult to spot because it's written in quite obscure language sometimes? Although I think that this claim applies to Camus less than it does quite a lot of existential and continental philosophers. I think Camus actually writes quite accessibly. You know, that there's a reason why he's such a favorite amongst a lot of philosophy students, is because, well, he's not like swimming through treacle all the time. He does kind of say what he means. I think that the reviewer is right in that a lot of the logical argumentation in The Myth of Sisyphus is in like the first 30 pages and the last 20 pages. And quite a lot in the middle is a little bit more illustrative, I would say, rather than argumentative. You know, the first 30 or so pages of The Myth of Sisyphus, from what I can remember off the top of my head, I might be getting the absolute page references wrong. Please don't like quote me on any of these casual videos. But from what I remember, the first 30 pages of The Myth of Sisyphus do deal directly with the problem of meaning. So Camus starts off from the idea that life has no inherent meaning. And so I think that one of the reasons this person is disappointed is because he thinks that this is a book arguing for the conclusion that life is absurd, when actually it's a book that begins with the premise that life is absurd. That may be where the confusion's arising. But essentially, yeah, Camus has the first 30 or so pages of the book saying, life is absurd, what are we going to do about it? And actually, there's quite a lot of very straightforward logical argumentation here. Camus' first premise is that life is meaningless. His second premise is that we crave meaning. And his conclusion is that we must learn to live without objective meaning. In some ways, that's a very straightforward argument, even if it's not kind of, even if it doesn't neatly fit into deductive form. Camus then also outlines some kind of auxiliary arguments. You know, he says, well, one way of confronting meaninglessness is to imagine that there's a kind of meaning, which is basically what he thinks that people like Chesterton and Kierkegaard are doing when they turn to God for meaning, because Camus, again, starts with the premise that a belief in God is basically philosophically indefensible, which, you know, you can argue with him about that. In fact, I would argue with him about that, and I'm an agnostic. But anyway, that is one of his auxiliary arguments. So then Camus says we're left with three options. We can either somehow come to terms with life's meaninglessness. We can throw our lot in with a religion or with God or with an idea of objective meaning, which he thinks is betraying our philosophical principles, or we can just cease to live. And, you know, obviously no one wants to do the cease to live part, hopefully. And Camus doesn't want to do the abandoning your philosophical principles part. And so he's left with this idea, right, okay, we've had three options. We've said, we can't do this one, we can't do this one, so we're left with the third one. We've got to learn to live without meaning. And then much of the rest of The Myth of Sisyphus, until right at the very end, where he again kind of re-illustrates this argument, is about exploring what it would mean to be an absurdist, or to be an absurd hero, as Camus puts it here, I think. And then, you know, he outlines a series of figures. He talks about Don Juan, and he talks about the actor, and he talks about, you know, various other ones, which I can't quite remember. But that's not straightforwardly argumentative. He's just saying what he thinks a person who lives without appeal would look like and how they might live. And I would certainly push back on the idea that this illustrative component of The Myth of Sisyphus is somehow idle or not doing anything. I think that when we're talking about these more existential styles of philosophy, we actually might leave something out if we're just following a proposition, 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 conclusion form, because they're dealing with aspects of human emotion, right? It's not as straightforward as we're proving something out in the world, or we're proving something according to the laws of logic. We're also illustrating a way of living life and almost endorsing it. You know, Camus here is saying, yes, I want us to live without appeal, or at the very least, he's saying he wants to live without appeal. I think that it would be incomplete if you didn't give some picture of what that looked like, right? It's all very well saying, oh, well, it's our only option to live without appeal, so we've got to do it. I think that that would be woefully unsatisfying as a conclusion. So these images he uses of the absurd heroes, and then eventually this idea of imagining Sisyphus happy, I don't think they're pointless, even if they're not straightforwardly logically argumentative. I think they provide a very valuable emotional impression of what Camus thinks being an absurdist would be like. And I think that is just as important as the argumentative portion of his book, if not more so. The argument in The Myth of Sisyphus isn't too hard to sell someone on if they are already on board with the idea that life is meaningless and they're already hesitant to turn to religion to solve whatever inner angst they have about that. They're probably already kind of broadly on board with this initial argument that Camus lays out. But they're still going to have the question, okay, Albert, I get where you're coming from, but how am I meant to put this into practice? And I think that the rest of The Myth of Sisyphus is an illustration of what this early version of Camus means by that. Even though, as I've talked about in the past, I think that he ultimately revises this quite considerably to incorporate a more community-focused idea of what it means to be an absurd person and an absurd hero. But anyway, I do see where this review is coming from, even if I would respectfully disagree. And I think that's the best kind of one-star review, right? That's why we're here. Right, our final one-star review is for the John Steinbeck classic Of Mice and Men, and it simply reads, read this for school, worst thing I've ever read, my eyes need formal apologies, When People Say Hell, I think they're referring to this book. Now, I don't really want to talk about Of Mice and Men for this review. I wanted to use it as sort of an illustrative example, because reading through the one-star reviews on Of Mice and Men, you have like tens, if not hundreds of ones just like this. You know, the one just above it on Goodreads says, reading this in school made me dislike this book so much, ha ha ha. And the one under it says, for AP language, unnecessary. I think that something is going wrong with the way that we teach literature if people are coming away from what is, I think, quite a compelling and engaging book with like a relatively straightforward plot and some quite thrilling elements, with the idea that it is simply dull. I think that on the one hand, introducing classics to people at quite a young age can be really helpful, right? I basically first read Shakespeare as a teenager for my GCSE English in the UK, and that was wonderful. It kind of, it sparked my love of Shakespeare, and I still really enjoy Shakespeare to this day. That, I think, is what can happen if you teach classics well at a relatively young age. If you'll bear with me a moment, I think that I have a few ideas about what might potentially be going wrong here. Certainly, when I ask people about how they studied literature at school, they quite often talk about how completely irrelevant the literature was made to feel. So they were discussing basically just historical or stylistic elements, right? Oh, how has the author used this word here? Or in what context was the author writing? And these are both, or can be both, fascinating. And the context in which an author's writing is to a certain extent important from getting the most from the text. But like, should we lead with that, right? Like, if I was trying to get you to read Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, or try to get you to enjoy it, right? Like, reading literature is meant to be, well, maybe not straightforwardly enjoyable in all cases, right? I'm not suggesting you should go and read like the most horrifying parts of Dostoevsky's Demons and come away feeling like all joyful about it, but it's meant to be engaging, right? It kind of, at its best, it can kind of grip you by the heart and take you in, and that can be fantastic. But if I was trying to persuade someone that Crime and Punishment is a book that you can get a lot from, or something that could be an enjoyable read, what would be a better way to go about it, right? Would I focus on the fact that Dostoevsky uses the word suddenly a lot, and how this really emphasizes the fast pace of much of the book, and the way that Raskolnikov's mental state is very urgent because he's very frightened and he's beating himself up and he's just an anxious chap. And as a result, a lot of things appear to him to occur suddenly, and that's reflected in the language of the book, right? I find that very interesting. Is that going to persuade someone to read Crime and Punishment or help them enjoy it? Almost certainly not. But if I said something like, Crime and Punishment is a book about how every single aspect of your rational self can be fixated on the correctness of a single deed, and when you carry it out, nonetheless, your emotional, instinctive, non-rational conscience will nag at you and it will scrape away at you, and with each passing page you're going to feel the layers of Raskolnikov's psyche come peeling away, you'll see his mind just be undone by this horrible act that he's committed and the way that he has killed someone. And all of that rationality is just straw. It's just paper. It can't bear the weight of his misdeeds. I think that's a more compelling sell for the book. It also just gives a better idea of what the book's about, right? You know, we can miss the wood for the trees, I think, a lot in the way that we teach children classic literature, because we focus on the way that authors might use words or particular historical context. And as I say, it's not those things aren't important. It's just that it's not a good way to sell someone on actually enjoying a book. If our goal for teaching children about literature, or teaching teenagers about literature, or teaching anyone about literature, is to increase their enjoyment of the text, increase their emotional engagement with the text, and also be able to look at the text in such a way that they can emerge from the experience of reading it a changed person, then I don't think that leading with those two elements is going to be conducive to that goal. That may not be your goal, right? I think that a lot of the goal of formalized education and literature, at least from my personal experience in it, was to understand what the author is saying and how they are using words. And again, there's nothing wrong with that, right? I do plenty of research into the authors that I talk about because I don't want to misrepresent them. I don't want to give my interpretation of one of their works and it turns out that it's totally at odds with what they actually thought. Nonetheless, I think that this is a poor reflection of what people actually do take away from literature. I think that at its best, reading something like Crime and Punishment or watching a Shakespeare play or Mary Shelley's Frankenstein is engaging with these texts is partly a conversation, right? You're looking at the ideas and the emotional journey represented in these books, and you're arguing with them and you're teasing them out and you're putting yourself in the minds of the characters. And you're being like, oh God, how would I feel in that situation? How are they feeling? Why are they feeling that way? Why would I feel that way? That's just a much more emotionally compelling experience than learning about particular word choices. And I'm not suggesting, again, I'm not suggesting that's not important. I'm just suggesting we might not want to lead with that when you're trying to convince, 13-year-old Joe that he should spend his time reading Frankenstein. I picked Frankenstein because that was one of the texts on my GCSE English course. When we were first learning about it, it kind of seemed like we were learning a bunch of stuff, which, sure, it's kind of interesting from a kind of outside view. It did not make me want to read Frankenstein or engage with Frankenstein on an emotional or intellectual level. Because, you know, the first thing we learned about Frankenstein, for example, was that it was written as this competition between Mary Shelley and a bunch of other authors, and that Mary Shelley was very young when she wrote it. Those are two interesting historical factoids. I don't see how that is a more compelling lead into learning about Frankenstein than saying, look, this is a book about how we can run ahead of ourselves when our intelligence outstrips our wisdom on an individual level and at a societal level when we don't question what kind of extra responsibilities technological advances are going to bring, when we don't take our creations, be they personal or societal, fully in hand and ask whether this is going to be for the good or the ill of humanity. And in the case of Frankenstein, the creation. Again, I think the second framing is just going to be more compelling than the first framing. It certainly would have had a higher chance of persuading me to read Frankenstein as a teenager. And if I had then gone and read it, I would have enjoyed it more. I didn't read Frankenstein for my GCSE English because I found it boring. And I've gone back and read it later, and I don't think it's boring at all. I think it's an incredibly fascinating text. I think it's very well written. I think the horror elements in it are deeply disturbing. But that only happened when I took an ideas first way of approaching the book. And I think that philosophy is generally reflected in the way that I approach things on my channel. And I don't know, I hope that that makes literature seem compelling. I don't know if it does, but I really hope that it at least is one step along the way to hopefully persuading more people that some of these classic works from the past truly are worth reading and revisiting and digesting and thinking about. So yeah, that's all I have to say on the topic, really. I think that we do children and teenagers a disservice by presenting literature to them in the way that we currently do. And I think that if we approached it more by looking at the ideas within the text and helping them understand why those ideas might be relevant to them today, I just think we'd have a lot more takers. And I think that more people would be convinced of the potential value of literature. I know, I don't know if that's a kind of somber end to this video, but I'm out of 1-star reviews. So yeah, I really hope you've enjoyed it. I didn't expect this video, which was meant to be quite lighthearted, to end on this note. But I don't know, maybe this is my small contribution to reforming the way that we might teach literature in schools. So thank you so much for watching. You can see the rest of my casual videos up here, and have an absolutely wonderful day.